Oil prices are rising on mounting tensions in a crucial shipping lane. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig in for Anu Anand. Good morning. The UK is chairing an emergency meeting right now about how to respond to Iran's seizure of a British tanker in the Persian Gulf on Friday. The BBC's Will Bain reports.
You are ordered to change your course immediately. If you obey, you will be safe, over.
You must not impair, impede, obstruct, or hamper the passage of the MV Stena Imperio. Please confirm that you are not intending to violate international law.
The tense ship radio exchanges between the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and the British Royal Navy's gunship, the HMS Melrose. As you'll probably know by now, the warning from the British ship wasn't heeded, and Iran seized the British-flagged cargo ship, the Stena Imperio, and its 23 international crew, which included sailors from Russia, Latvia, India and the Philippines. But why is the strait so significant that disruption to business there causes presidents and prime ministers to intervene? Professor Rocky Weitz is director of the Maritime Studies Program at Tufts University.
The Strait of Hormuz is the key maritime link between the Gulf with the Indian Ocean, and it is the key east-west maritime link between the oil-producing countries of the Gulf region, so Iran, Kuwait, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, UAE, as well as the liquefied natural gas producers, the largest exporter in the world of Qatar.
Big energy questions. So what about those countries that are big energy consumers? Cornelia Meyer is an energy analyst here in London.
The people who really should worry the most are the producers who get a lot of their oil through the Straits of Hormuz, which would be Korea, Japan, China, Taiwan, and also India.
So big issues for those economies thirsty for oil and gas. Questions too for global leaders on how to keep the key shipping route open. Rocky Weitz again.
This crisis in the Strait of Hormuz is a great illustration of why geography matters and how politics and geography and business mix to provide what is a global crisis in this one little strait in the south of Eurasia.
And of course, the longer the crisis in the Straits drags on, the longer those questions on cost, security, and access to vital resources will continue for all of those trading around the globe. In London, I'm the BBC's Will Bain for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. Stocks are flat as investors monitor those geopolitical tensions and prepare for a number of central bank decisions this week. The gains might be limited on global shares today, but in Shanghai, stocks surged on the first day of trading for a new Nasdaq-style board called the Star Market. It's the latest sign China is focused on opening up its capital markets. Art Anurag Koranyanovich is the boss of DBS Asia Capital in Hong Kong.
The average time for listing on China's A-share market can take companies more than 2 years. While for the Star Market, it can take just 3 months. This board also allows for companies which are still posting losses to list, which is a first in China. And then trading rules have also been loosened to give market forces a bigger role in setting share prices. Based on today's market performance, by midday, on average, the 25 companies that got listed were up 160%.
And as you said, clearly there's demand. But who's buying? Is it more institutional investors, or are we seeing mom-and-pop investors coming into this market?
Well, I think it's a combination, right? The first batch of 25 companies raised about 37 billion yuan, which was almost 19 or 20% higher than originally planned. There was a huge amount of oversubscription from both institutional and retail investors.
So is it riskier for those mom-and-pop investors to get in this market at this point? Are we going to see share? I mean, clearly, these companies can't sustain 500% gains.
I would say that they've put at least some safeguards there. The SSC requires a minimum asset of 500,000 yuan for each of the retail accounts to qualify for this new tech board investment. So a lot of the smaller, you know, mom and pops wouldn't be affected because they wouldn't qualify to be able to trade these stocks anyways.
Art Anurag Koranyanovich there. India says it's taking a billion dreams to the moon today after this hour launching its second lunar mission in more than a decade. Not everyone believes it's money well spent, though, as the BBC's Mike Johnson reports.
India, with its 1.3 billion people, has an economy which is expected to leap from the world's sixth biggest today to third within the next decade. Hundreds of millions of people there, though, still experience grinding levels of poverty. According to the World Bank, 20% of Indians still live on less than $2 a day. The World Bank also says that India received just over $3 billion in international aid in 2017. Some say that a country with a space program shouldn't be getting any foreign aid at all. We've been asking a few people on the streets of Mumbai how they feel about their government's focus on space exploration.
This is something the world is recognizing us for, so I think that's really good and I'm really happy for it.
Government should spend this much amount of money on buildings for the people who are not having homes to live, good toilets, public toilets, roads are not good.
So mixed views there from the streets of Mumbai. We're going to stay in India's financial capital to hear from Dr. Chaitanya Giri. He's a planetary scientist at the Gateway House Research Institute. He believes that India's space program brings clear economic benefits.
As you ramp up your space capabilities, you are able to spin off a lot of technologies developed into a commercial market. Electric vehicle technology, it has been given to Tata Motors. Fuel cell technology, this is something that you will see on the road. So going into space is an economic enterprise. You are creating industries which are relevant to the current times.
Dr. Susmita Mahanti is a leading Indian space entrepreneur. She believes every rupee her government throws into space is money well spent.
Having a space program is not a luxury, it's a necessity. The budget is around $1.5 billion today, and the US spends about $19 billion a year. Even a country like the US has about 20 million people living in abject poverty. So you have to solve problems that a country faces here on Earth. And at the same time, you can go out and explore space.
That's Dr. Susmita Mahanti ending that report there by the BBC's Mike Johnson. In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.